Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased once again this morning to be talking with some guests who are here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. Champaign-Urbana, the University of Illinois, once again hosting the event this year. It's the 8th annual festival. Films are being shown at the Virginia Theater in Champaign, and then during the daytime there are some panel discussions that take place at the Union on the U of I campus. A number of films will be shown, and people have come literally from all over the world, people who like movies and people who make them, to enjoy together some films and also to talk about them. And we're pleased here to have with us in the studio in this hour, Phil Morris. He is an actor and director. He's director of the film Junebug, and that's a film that will be shown tomorrow night at the Virginia Theater as part of the festival. It's also a film that is now available for rental if you want to see them. If you can't get to the festival and you want to see the movie, you can go down to wherever it is you rent movies and you can rent the movie. And it's a fine film. I saw it just last night and I enjoyed it a lot. Also here in studio with us is Scott Wilson. He is one of the actors in the film Junebug. He plays Eugene, and that may not mean anything to you unless you've seen the movie. We'll talk a little bit more about it. And he has been in a lot of movies. I'm just looking at the list of the performances that you've done, and let me just mention a few. He was in working most recently in Back. In addition to being in Junebug, he was in, let's see, Last Samurai and Monster and Pearl Harbor and the X-Files movie and G.I. Jane and Dead Man Walking and The Aviator and The Right Stuff and The Great Gatsby and In Cold Blood and In the Heat of the Night. And that's just a few of the more than 60. Also done some acting in television. So he has a little bit of experience acting in front of the camera.
A little bit.
Yeah. And we're here and would be happy to take questions, I'm sure, if people want to call in. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate it. The movie, just to let people in on the bones of the story so that they can get a sense of it, I think is the thing that sets the plot in motion is something that an awful lot of people have experienced, I think. At least it's about a couple who they meet and they fall in love and they get married very quickly. And it's about the two of them going to meet his family for the first time. So here's the new wife. She has not met them. They have not met her. And I think probably a lot of people have had that experience of, you know, having a significant other and meeting their family for the first time, which is one of the most stressful things, you know, you can probably go through. So that's basically the thing that starts it going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think clearly it's something that anyone who enters a new relationship has to experience or gets to experience, as the case may be. And of course, it is well mined in theater and movies. This is not a radically a novel plot, and that was very intentional. I feel like I sort of personally I leave it to the geniuses to discover completely new narrative territory. This is the first movie I ever made, and I feel like often when the aim of a film is to be absolutely original and novel in its story structure, that often what it's seeking to do is impress more than discover. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I think we set out to do in a large sense, and I think moment by moment in the movie, is to try to find what was surprising or funny or transcendent and also challenging and sometimes even confusing about the most basic circumstances of life. And so we chose very intentionally a story that could be considered perhaps even a cliche.
Yeah. Well, for the woman of this couple, for the woman, her name is Madeline. They meet in Chicago. She is owner of an art gallery, and sort of the thing that happens that gets the thing going is that she's decided that there's an artist that she wants to meet and hopes to represent in North Carolina. So, and it just so happens that his family lives close to where this man lives. So they decide she wants to go and meet the artist, and they decide, well, while they're there, they should go and see the family. And it is so for her, in a lot of ways, it's a serious culture shock. And I suppose anytime any individual family has its own culture, you meet your partner's family, it's going to be culture shock. But here for her, because of the way that she was raised and where she grew up and the kind of life that she lives, I think for her particularly to meet these Southern folks who are really a sort of an average working class Southern family,
middle class?
Okay.
Yeah, but...
Yeah. And it's this is her, you know, this is for her, this is a completely different world from the world in which she lives. Mm. Was there, I think, as I have read about the movie, I think a lot of people have talked a lot about the fact that it is set in the South, and it's where you grew up, in fact,
yes,
in North Carolina. Did you particularly want to do something that was set in the South or that was about Southerners? I mean, is the setting particularly important?
Well, it's a world in which I'm comfortable. And that I feel confident that the decisions that I might make, I can stand behind, you know, mm-hmm. and that I can make gut decisions that would be honest, or that my pursuit of being honest, that I can, you know, I have a good foundation for that. So and that, you know, I think in any movie, it's amazing how I think it's one of the great things about, you know, art, but in this case, movies, that when you like a movie, there'll be an element of that movie that you just think is the greatest. And if you don't like a movie overall, that very same element will be incredibly irksome to you, you know? And often it's the things the boldest choices that a movie will make will be those things that will thrill some and annoy others. Mm-hmm. So I set out to make a movie that was destined to, if it had a chance of thrilling some, I knew that it was also destined to annoy others. So this does answer your question, believe it or not, which is that I wanted to know that I could be confident in those choices, and that's a world in which I feel confident.
Let me mention something. When I first time I spoke to Phil, I read the script. I spoke to Phil. I realized that it was a small budget, and I realized that meant that you had to come in prepared. You had to know what you wanted to do. And from talking to him, I said he knows what he wants to do, and that. The nature of my role, my particular role, was that he's a quiet person. And I'm saying to myself, does he know how to do quiet? Does he know how to let the person live and so he'll survive the film and not become lost in the edit? he did. He knew what he wanted. He came in and... He was focused in a low-budget movie. That is very important. At the same time that he was focused and knew what he wanted, he gave the actors the freedom to discover the characters that they were playing. And that's truly a gift for an actor, to have a director who's able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested that I'm glad that you could be here, because I am imagining that there would be some real challenges in the part that you played, because the character is a very quiet and shy man, and I'm guessing that he must have the fewest lines of anybody in the movie. He doesn't talk a lot.
That's absolutely so.
Yeah, and that so for you as an actor, you would have to. I'm sure that you know, the director has communicates to you something about who this character is, but that for you as an actor, then you also have to decide who this person is and how it is that you're going to embody that character, what you are going to do, what you are going to bring to it to make that person seem real on the screen.
Well, you do. At the same time, you don't want to come in and be rigid about what you want to do, because then it's going to be flat. You have to, there has to be a sense of discovery, I think, for the actors as well. So the first scene that I was involved in was the scene where it comes early in the film where the air mattress is being blown up by the machine, and my character's standing there watching it unfold. And I sat there and I said, Phil knows what he wants. He knows mm-hmm. what he's how to go about getting it. So it gave me a sense of security to realize that.
Well, let me ask you about that scene. Now, here, as you say, here the family is preparing for the visit of the two people, the Madeline and George. People are coming from Chicago. And you're getting they're going to sleep in a spare room, and you're inflating this air mattress that they're going to sleep on. So here's the scene: you're standing there, and the air mattress is inflating, and you're standing there. You don't have any lines. You don't say anything. You're just standing there. I mean, when you're doing that, are you thinking about anything? Thinking about anything?
You start thinking, but that was Phil who stepped in and described the scene to me and told me what he wanted there. And of course, what I'm thinking in my head while that's going on is what I'm thinking. But by him telling me what he wanted, I knew that he understood and I realized that really, I didn't know if it would translate. Him understanding, being able to articulate that is one thing as a director, to be able to articulate what you want from a character in your piece is one thing, but then to actually put it into practice could be something totally different.
And it's interesting because in doing my job, I have to be very careful about the extent to which I talk to the actors about what the external purposes of the scene are versus what their characters' intentions and actions are about. For instance, I don't even know if we ever really spoke of one thing that was very important to me in the scene, because it's not something I would have wanted to impose upon Scott as an actor. But to me in that scene, it's very critical because he is staring at a very slow-moving, almost to the point of being still, object, mm-hmm. which we see it from his point of view. It's the first time in the movie where we actually look through a character's eyes and in order to relate to their experience. And what he sees is a full frame of two-dimensional, you could almost say, nothingness. And from that experience, he has a revelation. He says, I'm going to make her a bird, which he spends the whole rest of the movie doing, and I don't want to give it away, but who her is turns out to be in question. And then once he does make her a bird, for me, it's a very, very important part of the movie. And he has that idea on account of just staring. And it so happens in this movie, which I will say, if you, I hope has a lot of humor and action in it. There are also times where you're given the opportunity to do something very much like what Scott's character is doing in that first scene. And so in a way, it's meant to demonstrate the possibility that having those sort of empty, so to speak, experiences can lead to kind of a revelation.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly here reintroduce the guest. People might have tuned in and they wonder who it is they're listening to. We're talking this morning with Phil Morrison and Scott Wilson. They are here for Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival now going on in Champaign-Urbana at the U of I campus. And Phil is the director of the film Junebug that will be shown tomorrow afternoon at, tomorrow night, 7:30 at the festival. It's also available now on DVD, so if you'd like to see the film, you can go down to wherever you rent movies and you can see it. And Scott is one of the actors in the movie. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things I think is interesting about the movie, and I think maybe sets this kind of movie apart from some others, is that it engages the viewer in a lot of different ways. And I think one of the ways, at least I found myself, was that there are a lot of empty pieces of the story here. You suspect that there is an enormous backstory here that you're not given. So at least I found myself, as I'm watching it and I'm seeing these characters, I'm thinking, well, I'm trying to fill in the blanks. You sort of want to know, well, what went on? But there's two brothers, the one who stayed at home, the one that went. So you wonder, well, what's with the relationship between the two brothers? What's with the relationship between the parents? Why did George, the brother who leaves, why did he leave? What, you know, there's all sorts of things in here that you want to know that the movie doesn't really tell you. I mean, maybe it gives you reasons to. You can fill them in yourself, but it doesn't really tell you all that stuff.
This is Scott speaking, but it's an ensemble piece. It's an ensemble family drama comedy because there's a lot of humor in it. And I think it's like a lot of families, maybe particularly in the South, I don't know, but when I would imagine most everywhere, when you grow up, you spread your wings, and some of the birds fly far from home, and some of them stay close to home. And he's the son that left the nest and went far away. Why does it happen? I don't know. But again, it's a family drama, and it was interesting for me to see the characters evolve as we were shooting, like the mother, Celia Weston, who was so grasping in a way, wanting to hold on to her son that left the fold, that left the house, and longing for him in a way, mm-hmm. and for the son that has stayed, and it's just an interesting family yeah. comedy to me, drama.
It's what I would hope for in a way is that it might help in the smallest, most modest way to put into perspective that crazy need that we have to know why about things in the world, and especially the way the world is right now. I think it's always been that way, but there's always mm-hmm. examples of this, of things that are unanswerable. And in this case, you know, this movie is not like, you know, United 93. It looks in a much more in a smaller. It's inside one home, but that our crazy need to know why, you know, will. Completely bedevil us. And that's actually another place where I feel like Scott's character in a way stands for I think that Alessandro Nivola's character, George, and to some extent Madeline, his wife, stand for who I believe the audience might be and mm-hmm. who I probably am. And Scott's character, Eugene, I personally think stands for who we ought to aspire to be, because a word that Scott and I talked about a lot in preparation was acceptance, and that his real strength came from acceptance, and it's clear that he does not have this crazy need to understand why.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one point in the scene where you and your wife in the movie, that George's parents are sitting there, and she's and talking about this couple, and she's got real concerns about Madeline, George's mother. She is not really sure whether she's right. And you, the dad, you just at one point say they love each other. That's full stop. That's it. And it seemed like, you know, yeah, for him, the bottom line was, well, yeah, obviously these two people love each other. So that's just it. And that's, you know, on the one hand, you'd like to be able to live life that way, except life tends to be a lot more complicated than that. So it's pretty hard to do that.
Well, I think Celia represents the undying love of a mother. The uncompromised love of a mother, that she isn't willing to. I think maybe she doesn't. I don't want to speak on her behalf. I mean, Phil can do that better than me. He had the conversations with her, but she, that the mothers are that way with their sons, aren't they? They won't let go, and they think their sons are perfect. So that's. No one is good enough for a son, I believe, whoever it had been.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it also connects to this, I think, you know, very strange thing that about us as humans, that we have a real clear sense of what everyone else ought to do. And the closer someone is to us, probably the more defined a sense of that we have of what they ought to do or not do. And yet it's incredibly difficult, at least for me, to figure out what I ought to do. So somehow or other, we know best about what's good for everyone else and accept the fact that it's very difficult to know what about ourselves. And that's one of the things that I hope this movie is about. In the movie, The Rules of the Game, you know, the character famously says, you know, everyone has his reasons. And in a way, I just think that's a prescription for – it ought to be a prescription for every movie, really.
Yeah. How much did it cost to make Junebug?
Oh, $700,000.
Wow. That seems – even for a small budget movie, that seems like just a paltry amount.
Yeah, it was really small. And then – even with that budget, we dedicated ourselves to some things that made it even more difficult, which was shooting on film, being in North Carolina, and casting SAG actors of real accomplishment. With a budget like that, normally you would need to budge one way or another. You would shoot on video, or you would shoot somewhere where the actors already are, so you don't need to travel them. But it didn't make any time that there was a circumstance where that we could maybe make the movie under different terms than what I just said. I just decided I would rather not make it at all. There was one point Celia Weston, who Scott mentioned, who plays Peg, was connected to the movie for a very long time. And I don't think you even know this. There was a time where we had the opportunity to shoot the movie, but Celia wasn't available. And it wasn't a matter of then being able to postpone it. It was if we didn't shoot it right then, we would maybe never be able to make it at all. But it just wasn't worth it to me to make it without Celia. You know, we could have gone and tried to find someone else to play Peg, but I didn't have a feeling that I must make this movie no matter what the circumstances, which I think that's usually an attitude I think that is honored, you know, by hook or by crook, and no matter what, you'll make the movie so you have your movie. But I didn't really feel that way. I only wanted to make it if it could be made, you know, under the right circumstances.
I think Angus should be mentioned here.
Oh yeah,
as well. Who wrote the script?
Your screenwriter.
Yeah, and it was, and Phil and Angus had a great relationship. They were both from the same town, weren't you?
Yeah. We've known each other my whole life.
So I mean, it was, and he was there quite a bit, but it was a terrific script.
And how long did it take to shoot? Or how long did you shoot?
And well, 20 days.
So again, that's that's a very short, it's a very short shooting schedule.
Yeah, and it was, you know, as Scott brings up Angus, it was, you know, that script is why we were able to have the cast that, you know, that we had. You know, we were able to shoot film and be in North Carolina because I just kept insisting and insisting. But the part about having the really strong cast was because we had on paper this really great script. I had never made a movie before.
Well, it was the script, and you still need to feel comfortable that the director has a vision and knows what he wants to get out of that script. Mm-hmm. And that was there. And from the beginning, no one made any money on the film. That wasn't the idea. The idea was to make a good film from everyone's point of view.
Yeah.
And But at the same time, the producers made a generous, you know, a fair, generous thing for the back end. If the film should make money, then everyone should make a little money. So, and but at the same time, when you're making that film, you know that it isn't a film that's going to cause you to retire. You know, it's a small film. It's a small film that hopefully will speak to people and remind them of people they know or maybe their own family members. Yeah. Or maybe open the door on a piece of life that they're unfamiliar with and help them recognize that there are other lifestyles out there that they're not aware of. So, I mean, it's hopefully a slice of life that has some humor in it and some very, very... Loved watching all the actors in the film. They're all wonderful.
And the 20 days, by the way, was terrifying.
Well, I'm sure it means that you got to know what you want to do beforehand. You can't be spending a lot of time standing around thinking, well, should we do this or should we do this? And I'm sure that it also doesn't allow for many, very many takes. So you then when you go to edit the movie, what you got is what you got.
But it never, while we were shooting, it never felt frantic. It never felt as though we have to rush and get this shot in. If that's thanks to Phil. I mean, he was able to make everyone feel like they had as much time as they needed to arrive at what he wanted, and he was uncompromising in getting what he wanted. He would not settle for less than what he wanted, and there was time to do it. And I think that a lot of that, he was aided in a lot of that by his casting, because he cast people who are professionals and who have been there before. Not that there isn't room for bright young talent. There is.
Yeah, and, you know, and I think part of that is that that decision about, as a director, about, you know, what you want, I think has to be, you have to understand that your preconceived notion about what it will be like isn't necessarily right and isn't necessarily what you want. I think the worst thing you can do is think that you have a good take when it sounds like what you had heard in your head previously. In fact, I think it's my job to not have a preconceived notion about how an actor will behave or sound, but rather, to me, we can move on. We have a good take when my gut tells me that was authentic, what the actor did, but also completely surprising to me, completely unlike what I might have imagined it was going to be like. That, to me, is when it's really good, because as an audience member in the theater, that's what I want to experience. I thought, oh my gosh, that is completely true to me, and yet not like anything I might have thought myself. That is what's inspiring to me. I mean, I think of directing a movie as being kind of like you're the most privileged audience member. Every day you get to go and watch this movie unfold before you in a way that better be not what you expected it to be. Otherwise, it would be boring. Because if a movie's like what you expect, same way as a director, and yet then you can say, oh, wait, everybody, stop, and you can go whisper to somebody involved, whether it's an actor or the production designer or the director of photography, and say, what if the movie were like this? And then what I want to see is what happens on account of the fact that I said what I said, rather than see what I said specifically come to fruition. That would be boring to me. I can think of that already in my brain. I don't need to see it in a movie.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have a caller I want to get, and then again introduce again the guests. Phil Morrison, he's the director of Junebug. It's a movie that will be shown as part of Roger Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival tomorrow night, 7:30 at the Virginia Theater. So it is possible to see it on a big screen, and if you don't get a chance to do that, go down to wherever it is you rent your movies, because you can see it that way. It is out on DVD. And also here in studio with us is Scott Wilson. He's an actor. He's been in a lot of movies, and he was in this one as well, in Junebug. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller over in Indiana to talk with on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Actually, I'm sorry I'm asking this question. It's one of those programs you have, David, where, you know, about every sentence is something brand new and opening for somebody who hasn't experienced that world. But you mentioned something which allowed me to get into a question that perhaps both guests would like to speak to, but certainly the director. You mentioned about the you weren't frantic, things were smoothly going, and I was wondering about just on the technical side, a tempo thing, you know, like, God, they're on the night, like you talk about a basketball team or something. I presume that happens, especially with ensemble acting and stuff. And I just wondered, when that does happen, does that usually mean that you've got a hold of a good subject matter here, and it's going to be a decent film and something like that? Secondly, I am interested if the director could say something about when he decided that film was going to be his career. I love films. In fact, I just rewound one and just stopped. I was hoping I'd make the time element perfect, and finally the noise went away. But although I appreciate him, the world I hear talked about, like somebody talking about, well, I can move the camera here and maybe over there and stuff like that, that's all, you know, brand new to me. And I was wondering when that kind of consciousness appears to a person, when they become... they realize that they want to be a director. From your experience, I wonder if it's common to a lot of directors, you know, the same period of life, or it's, you know, I imagine there's odd ones that come on very early, very late, but just for the normal run things. I was wondering how that comes about. Those kind of visual things of looking at stuff, I found very interesting when it was first, you know, explained to me what the hell was going on in this movie, you know, and since that time, I've never been able to talk to anybody that's done any movies of any appreciable stance. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, I should say I'm sorry that I hadn't really said very much in terms of your biography and your background, so you can talk a little bit about how you... One thing I guess I would say is this was your first feature. Right?
Yeah, it was. And you know, the first question that the gentleman asked actually taps into something very significant for me that I have to be honest about. When he was talking about that sense of when you kind of, you know, when his analogy to a basketball team, which is that I'm pleased that to Scott it didn't seem frantic. It was important to me that it not. But inside, I was completely frantic. And what the gentleman asked is actually really, like I said, is really significant, because I have, leading up to this movie, I have directed other things. I directed a television show, and I directed a lot of TV commercials and such. And it was important to me, even in that work, that the acting be good. And the way I would always make that happen is to try to create a circumstance of that kind of momentum. And often with actors, when you finally hit on something, the best thing I think to do is to just say, keep going, and not stop and give them a note or say, this is what I think it should be like, but to say, this is feeling good to me. So if we don't even cut, if we just go again, then it will become transcendent. And what I have to acknowledge about our 20-day shoot is that, I mean, I feel kind of uncomfortable saying this, but it is so, that one of the things that was often frustrating to me It's just at that moment where the actors were so good that I felt like if I then just left them alone, they would go to some place beyond good. That would often be where we had to stop, where the time element of this movie, in order to have the entire movie shot and not be done and only have half the movie shot, required that that was where we would have to then draw the line. And that means always drawing the line at something that was quite good, no doubt. But I have to admit, I often wondered with these great actors, if we had had 40 days, which still is a short schedule, instead of 20, what might have that really been like? If there had been that moment where they could have done just what they wanted to do on account of everything I said. I'm not saying to have had nothing to do with it. And so, and some of the franticness on my part inside was due to never giving up on the desire to have enough time to get to that place that I just described, and that I think the caller actually described quite well. Mm-hmm. What I would say is, and this is a long answer, but I think it's a significant question. What it's really pleasing to me is that the say that this movie, this theoretical movie, had existed, the one that all with all of these takes that you know were existed in the ether. The response that I would want people to have to that movie, that I would desire an audience to have to that movie, is exactly the way audiences have responded to the one that does exist. And that is at first a relief and then something much greater than a relief, you know, to me. But there was a time where I was terrified because of this. I felt like there was something that Scott and everyone might have done that I wasn't, that the circumstances didn't give us an opportunity to do. Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Now I'll ask Scott, that's, you know, put yourself in that situation. Suppose that you did had 40 days instead of 20 days and you shot the movie in 40. Do you think it would have been a better movie?
I don't know. The analogy that he used of a basketball team. I think again, it's an ensemble piece, and there were a lot of scenes that there were more than two actors in it. But when actors are on a roll, it's like being hot in a basketball game when you can't miss or when you're stuffing every shot that someone's trying to put up. You get on those rolls, and there is a feeling on some sets when you're working that there's something. I guess it's called creativity in a way. I don't want to be precious, but I mean, I guess that there's a, you feel that. You feel it when you're hot, when the teams have played a little basketball. And you know when you're hot. You know when your teammates are hot. You know when you're on a team that's able to do something, when you're with a team that's able to do something. That feeling was on this set. You know, it's good to feel that it's the creative process in a way. I mean, and when you're able to, sometimes it can be very frustrating if you're on a set and it isn't happening, and you know it isn't happening, and you're saying, "What can I do to make it happen? What can I do to help make it happen?" So, but. Everyone has to. I think that you will experience in a lot of smaller budget films. They're not small films, but they're smaller budgeted films. I think that the actors and the the lead of the director, but then the cast and the crew, everyone is really pulling more for the film. If they sense that the director and the actors are focused and are going for something special, the crews, everyone starts pulling on the same end of the rope. Everyone's trying to make this thing work as well as it can. And everyone on the set starts knowing you have something. And that's kind of fuels it to another level. So it's it's exciting. It's fun to do it.
I want to get back for at least a couple minutes to the other question that the caller asked, just about, Phil, about your background and about how and when you decided that you would like to make movies.
Oh, gosh. I decided somewhere a little bit before high school. I had Roger Ebert had a real part to play in that, as I imagine he might for many, many people. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and watched him and Gene Siskel on PBS, on our PBS affiliate, and that made me aware for the first time of movies that weren't Hollywood commercial fare, and for whatever reason that was really intriguing to me. And I actually told a story at the festival the other day, which is that I, after seeing Sneak Previews, was the show was called then, I mentioned to my mom, about these movies, these art movies, and she, I guess decided, well, I guess if he's interested in that, he's old enough then for us to take him, and so we went to see Atlantic City, the Louis Malle movie, Atlantic City, and what I mentioned was a big deal for me then, and so I can thank Roger Ebert for this. Was it was also my first taste of nudity on the screen, and that's an exciting thing for a kid. So maybe that was it. Maybe that was like, this is the racket for me. and then actually I saw another film critic, a man named Godfrey Cheshire, speak in North Carolina about film, and he said something that blew my mind, whether one agrees with him or not. He talked about Gandhi, the movie Gandhi, and he just tore it to shreds. And because he this critic was Godard in Fassbinder would be his, number one. And so then that was fascinating to me, because I thought, well, Gandhi, that's an Academy Award winning important movie about, lofty subject matter and so forth. How can that not be great art? And yet this person who's clearly loves movies and is intelligent said that. So that really blew my mind, So what's actually film critics had a lot to do for me with making me excited about movies. And I think it's common if you make movies, to complain about critics and their role. But I actually I love film criticism and read it and enjoy it. And I feel like I have to be ready to accept when if a critic doesn't like what I do.
Let's try and get another caller in here. We're coming into our last about 7-8 minutes. We have a caller in Crete on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to commend Mr. Wilson for some magnificent performances since the 1960s, especially his amazing performance in Cold Blood. That performance really got to me, of course, Robert Blake's too. I just wondered, Mr. Wilson, how you got that role. Working with Brooks must have been exciting, and playing the role in the house where the Clutter family was murdered must have been somewhat amazing. And have you had any relationship with Mr. Blake since then, and what do you think of his later problems?
Well, excuse me, I had to cough. How did I get the role? I'll try to do this quick. I was on the set of In the Heat of the Night. That was my first film. And the day I finished, Mr. Poitier, Sidney Poitier, asked me if I was up for In Cold Blood. I said, well, actually, he asked me that prior to that. I said, what's that? He said, it's something you should be up for. Without my knowing it, he called the director, Richard Brooks, who he had worked with in a film called Blackboard Jungle, I believe. and suggested, told Mr. you know, talked to Mr. Brooks about me, Richard Brooks, and then Quincy Jones also, who was involved with In the Heat of the Night, called Richard Brooks and also recommended me for the role. At the completion of In the Heat of the Night, I went over to meet Mr. Brooks, and that started a 6-week process that ultimately led to my getting the role. What was it like to work with Richard Brooks? He was a volcano that you didn't know when he was going to erupt. You just knew that he was because he was an active volcano. And it was kind of a love-hate relationship. But you knew that he was very focused and dedicated and knew what he wanted in the film. As far as Robert Blake goes, I loved working with him. We bonded. It was a great working relationship. It's just awful what's happened with him in that situation and with the Bonnie Lee Blakely. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on it, but I visited him when he was in jail and I testified at his trial. I was one of the last two witnesses. I never thought he did it. I still don't. And I think that pretty much covers that.
All right. Well, I don't know if it...
But thank you for your kind words.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and the clock is running down. I wanted to ask Phil... One other thing about your movie, about Junebug, I thought it was interesting, and some of the things I read about it says that there are some audiences, apparently some people who have seen it, think that you're making fun of these people, that you're intending to denigrate them. Now, and I just read that, I had some things about the movie, and I read that after having seen the movie. And I thought, well, I didn't feel that way. My wife watched it with me. She said, I didn't feel that way. And I thought that was really – and some of the comments you made about that response was, well, that certainly was not what you had in mind. And I thought that was interesting and strange, I guess, that some people would have that reaction, that would think somehow that you were intending to ridicule these folks. But the Southern people in the movie.
Right. Well, I actually did not – that was not my intention, but I had had great awareness that people would think that. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think it's that strange that people think that, because I think that, especially in the United States, any movie, any work that confronts class is going to inspire that reaction in some people. You know, it's a very it's a trigger, you know, and so I accept that people have that. Actually, people have it about equally about the Southern family, as well as the cosmopolitan, sophisticated character of Madeline. Plenty of people think that it denigrates and is unkind to her. Mm-hmm. I think it. It just depends upon where you're coming from. Like I said, the intention of the movie goes right back to that idea of everyone has his reasons, and I intended for it to just be open and clear-eyed about people, and accept that people do things that aren't always pleasant to us. I am pleased that for the most part, it seems to me, people have not had that reaction. But I think a movie that dedicated itself to avoiding that reaction in anyone would be ridiculous and trite and dishonest.
I've had my experiences with people that have seen the film quite the opposite. I've heard a lot of people say, well, he's just like so-and-so, or she's just like some member of their family. So mm-hmm. I that's the only type of reaction that I've had. No one has mentioned to me that they felt that the film was poking fun of a group of people. A lot of people did see the humor in the piece, and there is humor there, but not the type of humor that you're laughing at the characters, but with the characters, I think.
Yeah. So you got the possibility to direct another project now?
Yeah, I'm taking it slow about that. There are a couple of things, including something written by Angus McLaughlin, who wrote Junebug, that I'm very, very slowly working toward. But I want to be patient. So that it definitely will happen, but not tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, we got to stop because we've come to the end of the time.
And you have Haji coming up, right?
Haji's coming up next.
Well, you guys will have a
chance
good time.
To get to know him.
A little bit, and he has. You'll see. He has great insight. All so right. Stay tuned, everybody.
Yeah, he's going to be terrific. Another Georgian.
Yeah.
Our guests here this morning, Scott Wilson, an actor in the film Junebug, and Phil Morrison, who is the director. And you may indeed, if there are tickets, you may have an opportunity to see Junebug tomorrow night at Roger Ebert's Overlook Film Festival. Otherwise, you can go down to wherever it is you rent movies, and you can rent it, and you can see it that way.
Or you can buy it.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you, Scott.
As spoken as a man who's going to get something out of this.
Maybe.
Someday, maybe.
Someday in 50
someday,
years.
Maybe. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, David.